Hello and welcome to Register, the podcast about architecture and landscape from the Kingston School of Art in London. My name is Andrew Clancy. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Anna Minton. Anna is a writer and journalist and reader of architecture at the University of East London. And in this conversation, we roam quite widely. I mean, Anna first started out working in journalism, working in some incredible places, including Northern Ireland, and then developed a particular interest in the politics of the built environment and the underlying forces that were shaping the streets and spaces of our towns. This led her to work for various think tanks and then ultimately to start writing her own works to kind of document what she was finding. The first of these books, Ground Control, dealt with London and the birth of a form of planning which privatised huge sections of the city, presenting itself as part of an urban realm but being quite distinct with different rules, different possibilities, and a far thinner political possibility in terms of rights of self-expression. And she followed this up with another book, Big Capital, Who is London For?, dealing with the housing crisis in London in particular. And the interesting things about these books is that although they are in relation to the cities that Anna knows very well, their forces are being felt all over the world, particularly in the English-speaking world. And in this conversation, she also touches on her new work, which does seek to address some of these issues on a global scale. We also talk about the ethical dilemma of being an architect, necessarily involved in aspects of the world from capital to planning regulations, which are far beyond our control, and therefore always running the risk of being somehow complicit in aspects that we may not be fully comfortable with. And we talk about the need to balance this, the need to understand that while you can't control everything, that you still need to work forward confident that you can make a difference in a positive direction. And all of this, I think, made for a very fruitful chat. I certainly enjoyed it, and I hope you do too. I'll catch you at the end. Thanks a million. Anna Milton, it's absolutely a privilege to have you here in the Kingston School of Art. It is great to have you here as a guest speaker and to have this time for this conversation. I mean, you're an esteemed thinker about the built environment and the politics of the built environment. But you didn't start there, right? So like, how what's your pre-story before Ground Control? How did you end up there?
Yeah, if you told me when I was leaving university that I would be working again in a university and I would be a writer focusing on this topic, I wouldn't necessarily have expected that. My plan was to go into journalism, and that's what I did when I graduated. So I spent my 20s in a variety of journalism jobs, but some of them were on planning, housing, and property magazines, which actually turned out to be very useful for what I'm doing now. But I pursued that career in journalism and I ended up working on the Financial Times, which was really great experience. And actually, I'd say in many ways, I still think the FT is an excellent paper and I still write for them from time to time. But it wasn't really me. I wanted to write about social policy. So I left the FT and I moved sideways and I started to work for think tanks and policy organisations. And I did that for a few years, organisations like the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, CABE as was, various others. And again, I wasn't sure that was completely me either, because think tanks very often had a political agenda and it was quite tricky to do the things that I really wanted to do. But I was lucky enough to write a series of reports, the first of which was about gated communities and ghettos in America, and looking at whether or not — that wasn't my terminology, that was what I was asked to write about. The publisher was actually the RICS, and they wanted to see if those trends were coming over to the UK. The second report, that did really well. It was one of those unexpected moments which it just captured so much attention. And actually, the RICS partnered with Demos and they published another report by me. It was supposed to be on segregation and polarisation in Newcastle. It was supposed to be called A Tale of Two Cities. But for various reasons, it became the story of cultural regeneration in Newcastle, and it became called Northern Soul, which shows you something of the politicisation when you have a think tank backing a report. They didn't really like the Tale of Two Cities take on things. So that was an interesting project. And then the third report was on the privatisation of public space. And when I'd done these three pieces of work, I thought to myself, I'd really like to write a book about this. And fortuitously, it happened. You know, luckily enough, I met an agent and I got a proposal together and I got taken on and I got a publisher and it happened. And I never expected that architects would be the discipline that were the most attracted to the book. I thought, if anything, it would be planners, possibly sociologists. There was a lot of criminology in ground control. But it was actually architects who were the most interested. So I started talking at lots of architecture departments, and I then was offered a job in the architecture department at the University of East London, where I still am now. That's it, really.
Yeah.
And since then, I've had this sort of portfolio career where I've kept up with my journalism to an extent. I write books, so I wrote Big Capital, Who Is London For?, on London's housing crisis, and I'm now working on a third book looking at the themes in both ground control and big capital on a more global canvas, particularly looking at the impact of North American policies. So I think that sort of broadly takes us up to where I am now. And yeah, there's the academic side as well. Now I also write for academic audiences as well, and I teach students and have that relationship with other students and scholars, which also adds to my work.
Because one of our interviewers later in the series is going to be Alison Killing, who's an investigative journalist, but via architecture, right? So I'm not even sure if she'd self-describe as that, actually. She's an architect, but she's done deep investigative work using her architectural skill set, and then now we have an investigative journalist who, as architectural thinker, and I kind of like the mirroring of that. One of the things that's kind of, I think, I can't speak for all architects, obviously, but one of the things that's brilliant about your books is how lucidly and clearly you write, but also how deep you go. Like, the research is thorough, it interweaves a lot of various things, from crime statistics to planning policies to their antecedents in history. And so forms of urban experience, I suppose, that appear somehow inevitable, because that is, I think, the quotidian experience of the urban realm, is somehow this is inevitable change, become crystallised and clear in your work. Do you know what I mean? In a way that you can name things that were hard to spot before. And I think that we might return to that, because one of the things that I wanted to ask you then was, I did know that in your career as a journalist, you did do a lot of work, or some work at least, in Northern Ireland, where there is a militarisation of urban space and there is a politicisation of urban space. And I was curious, as an Irish person, is that also part of the mix in forming what attracted you to this? I mean, Belfast is such a singular experience, right? Or was then, in particular. I mean, I'm just curious, how did you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing to add, just before I talk to that, is that I did a history degree. So that was, my undergraduate degree was modern history. So I think inevitably I bring that lens to it as well. But just to come back to your point, yeah, I mean, covering Northern Ireland as a young journalist in my mid to late 20s was an incredible experience, and it marked me really profoundly. I'd never been to Belfast. I went for the first time in 1994, when I was 24, and it was just such an experience. you know, I realised, I thought I was quite a political person. I thought I really understood, you know, British politics as much as, you know, someone of my age who thought that they were up to date with things would. And I realised that I had no idea. You know, it was just really clear that this was Britain's war and we had not been told about it. We were just inured by it. You know, it was just, oh, another soldier shot dead in Northern Ireland at the end of the news. And, you know, people barely paid any attention. And here you had this city. I spent time in Belfast and in Derry. It was a really fascinating experience. And to with regard to the militarization of the city, that struck me really profoundly. So to see traffic lights which had barbed wire on them, and to be interviewing somebody in their home, and to have a platoon of soldiers marching by outside, or to have the watchtowers.
Yeah.
I don't know if those are still in the city.
They're not the same, though. It's become much more like a normal British city.
Yeah.
The surveillance infrastructure is dissolved.
Yeah.
It's present.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Sorry, I cut across you, Anna. Sorry.
Yeah. No, and I mean the peace lines.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had no idea what these peace lines were. You know, they were in fact walls separating one community from another. So yes, the architecture of the city, I mean, the conflict is writ so visibly in the spatial configuration of the city. And so I was really profoundly struck by that. But, you know, if you'd asked me when I was writing Ground Control, oh, is this partly affected by your experience in Northern Ireland? I wouldn't have thought that was the case. But you never know really
never know
why it is that you are drawn to covering certain topics.
It's like, the reason I ask is because there's things that you point out in your books, and we're going to get into them now, and then once you've seen them, you can't unsee them, right? And some of them have become so standardised in our discourse now because of your work that our listeners might be surprised that they were new ideas, or relatively new ideas, when they first arrived. But I'd say Northern Ireland, it's like, I mean, I taught there for a long time, and I mean, one piece of research that one of my students did, which was so beautiful, was she traced all the underground culverted rivers in Belfast, and they would have obviously set up mills, and then workforces would have divided on sectarian barns either side of the river, and those rivers now no longer appear, they're underground, but one of them followed most of the peace walls. And so there's this old correlation between rivers, community, separation, division, and then this contested urban realm, which is the thing that you're talking about, and things looking like one thing but doing another, like social housing that is in fact a watchtower, or that kind of thing. Or a motorway for traffic improvements in Belfast, which was actually used for segregation purposes, which are again these kind of devices of urban form, which we would have been familiar with from, say, America and other places, which were used in very similar ways. And then what you were tracking with Ground Control and then in Big Capital was something less obviously visible, like somehow more insidious in some ways. If we can get into that, I mean, Ground Control is really to do with who owns our streets and who owns our public spaces, if I'm to... Am I missing? I'm kind of, it is broadly it. So maybe we can get into that a little bit. So who owns London, and who owns the streets and the squares in London?
Yeah, so really, I mean, a key theme there is that we've thought that the streets are public, and they've always been public, and that's just the way it is. And one of the big arguments in Ground Control was that actually the streets haven't always been public, and increasingly they are not public again. And so I was looking at the sort of model rolled out in places like Canary Wharf or the Broadgate Centre, where you have a large private estate which is owned by probably a global corporation, and they own that whole, you know, very large chunk of city. completely control it, control access and behaviour within those areas. But when Canary Wharf and Broadgate were being created in the 1980s, these were finance centres. They were built in former industrial parts of London, and they were built, you could argue, in the image of business to meet the needs of business. And what I was trying to say in Ground Control is that actually that model, which came to be in the 80s, has begun to spread across every town and city, large and small. Every new development is now built on this privatized model, where a global developer like Lendlease will, you know, own this whole neighborhood. And, you know, that creates a very different urban environment, and ultimately not a democratic one, because there are all these restrictions on behavior, you know, from the sort of fairly innocent, you might say, no cycling, no rollerblading, to the more clearly political, no begging, no homelessness, no filming, no taking photographs. And then for me, this is the litmus test, no political protest. So these spaces aren't democratic spaces. But when I say that we've had this feeling that the streets of the city have always been public, they haven't. They weren't public in the 18th century and the early 19th century. Actually, the Georgian squares and terraces of a city like London, which are considered some of the finest parts of our urban heritage, those were owned by aristocratic landlords. They were gated, they had lots of security. Members of the public were not allowed in. And this, as democracy gained in power, and central government, local government expanded, there was actually significant public protest against this, which led to a number of parliamentary inquiries in the mid-19th century, as a result of which it was ruled that henceforth local authorities had to adopt the streets and public places, which means that they would control them, no matter who owned the land. So that's why we've had this idea that the streets are public, and they've always been public, but they haven't. It was a hard-won democratic achievement. And at the crux of the argument, you know, I was saying now it's going into reverse. But just to sort of highlight perhaps, and maybe this kind of sheds some light on how I actually go about researching this sort of thing. You know, I was already quite well into researching and writing Ground Control when I was in the British Library working on this part of it. And I came across this journal article in, I think it was the Journal of Historical Geography. And it was by someone called P.J. Atkins. And it had been written, you know, quite some while beforehand. I just stumbled across it. And this is the piece that detailed how there had been these protests in the mid-19th century against the gating off of London squares, and how that had been overturned. And it was literally one of those sort of eureka moments where I thought, I've got the story. And, you know, so I think it's sort of taking a kind of journalistic approach to academic research and seeing that there's a real brilliant story there, which, you know, and so I tried to bring that out in the book.
Yeah, and you did really beautifully. It's interesting. In 2015, 2016, I might be wrong, we were asked to do, with some friends, a temporary pavilion on Granary Square near Liverpool Street. And we actually had been thinking about some of the ideas in your book, and our whole thing was a meditation on public space, non-commodified public space. It seemed to be that what you could do there is buy an expensive Indian, and that was nice, or you could
you know, you could look beautiful and lie on the grass for a while, but move on at specific times. And you couldn't really do anything else. And so we made a pavilion of park benches and arcades and places to hide, and the facade as a public space, and trying to make it. And of course, the estate's operators didn't realise it was until it was too late, and they used to give out that they couldn't see if somebody was drinking in the pavilion at midnight or hanging out. And I think it was the bit we got most pride of that one was the cider bottles in the pavilion that couldn't have been policed in this space. And that comes out of your thinking and you pointing at these things. And there is this question, which is that, like, the beauty of being able to do nothing and to be not moved on and not need to buy something is the most profound thing you can do in a public space. And if that's not present, a lot of other activities aren't present in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And it's this kind of thing where that's the baseline that's removed in these privatized spaces. And as you say, no protest, but as I even understand it, no political discourse of any kind. Right? I couldn't even put a pamphlet around or something like that. That would be a problem in those spaces.
That's right.
And there's this kind of strange thing of a kind of commons, inverted commons, being presented by a city where certain forms of discourse aren't possible. But to the urban inhabitant, it can feel pretty seamless with the broader city, right? That you're transgressing and walking through these lines where you have got very different relationships with the built environment. And your second book kind of went further and started to look at housing, how the very fabric of our cities, the very places we live in, are also subject to these forces in a very different way, but probably more terrifying in some ways, in the senses of there's a housing crisis in most developed societies under, say, climate-driven migration and other factors. We know that that's not going to go away for a long time. And the housing establishment of most cities, which used to be the fabric out of which they were made, has become a commodity by which wealth is transacted now. This globalized, financialized system placing its wealth in housing or another, mainly housing, right, to try and protect its wealth is relatively new.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about the landscape of the last 30 years. Yeah. Really, you know, the privatization of the city, which I talk about in Ground Control, was happening before the financial crash, and so was the commodification of housing and property and the housing crisis. But post-financial crash, the housing crisis became really, really acute for a number of reasons. But I think I'd see the sort of the baseline theme is this drive to extract the maximum value out of land and property, whether that be in the spaces of the city. So that could be in a place like Granary Square and King's Cross, or, you know, any other of the new sort of place-making environments that we hear so much about, or whether it's in all the luxury apartment developments. You know, that's the baseline to sort of extract value. And very often that began in the areas of the post-industrial city where prices were initially cheap, they were well located, so there was the potential to make large gains in value. And then, like I said, the impact of the financial crash had a huge effect on the housing crisis.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, gentrification, I suppose, is a word that's used a lot to describe that process. Or maybe that's an archaeology of this. You know, the kind of New York Nolita becomes an area, or whatever, Soho becomes, which is just an area developer named as an area to move value upwards. And that was sort of like constructed but also quasi-organic within the kind of demographics of a city, like, say, like London or like New York. And then this latter stage of it is much more constructed, much more large scale. In some senses, much less interested in whether actually these things are useful in some senses. Because am I correct in thinking that some housing is constructed purely, it doesn't really matter if anybody lives there, it's an asset that's holding value for somebody somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the argument I'm interested in exploring in my new book actually, I really want to look at the fact that this isn't gentrification,
yeah,
as we have been used to understanding it. You know, a much slower process which might take place over a generation, yes, driven by economic forces and consumer preferences. But this, you know, this flood of capital into the city since the financial crash, this isn't gentrification, this is something else. And it's not about places. It's not about what people want in cities, because as you say, very often these places aren't even there for people. You know, large numbers of the apartment blocks created are not, you know, are empty. The phenomenon of the hollowed out city is becoming a recent concern.
And this is interesting because these things don't happen in a vacuum. They are produced from policies and regulations, sometimes accidentally, right, and sometimes quite constructively. And sometimes those regulations are born from noble impulses, you know, like crime control or any of these things. Like this is to do with the privatized public spaces and things. And misunderstanding of human psychology, like that people ask for more security, but as soon as they're in a space with more security guards, they want less security or something, or they don't feel more secure. And then we have the situation where governments seek investment to build housing or to incentivize construction as some way driver of the economy, which might be the impulse way back for some of these things. And then you have this completely internalized system, which has really no connection with the local demographics, the local need, if we want, because its dynamics are entirely global. And interested in a kind of a globalized urbanism, which is this, I mean, it's interesting because you said placemaking earlier on, which is a word I've always been really confused by. This, it's almost cynical in its construction.
Well, I think it's deliberately vague.
Yeah. And then we're ending up in these places that you're describing in this, and the book sounds very interesting. Which are they places? I mean, you know, they're kind of no places in a way.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember, you know, quite a while back, probably when I was writing Ground Control, Non-Places became quite a well-known book. And yeah, I mean, I think those themes have just continued. But just to come back to your point about policy, something I'm really keen to point out, you know, in all my work, is that policy is critical. You know, these things don't just happen. Mm. And I get so frustrated with the approach that sees, you know, oh, the city gentrification, it's sort of this natural process. You can't really do anything about it. You can't really interfere. You can't really interfere in the market. You know, actually, it is specific policies. It is interference which has led us, you know, to all of these things. You can track them back, and I suppose that's what I try to do. You know, look at a place or an issue and track it back and see which are the policies and the unintended consequences which have led us to where we are.
Yeah, it's kind of... And you're doing this now in this conversation because you keep and enjoying it going back, and now you've introduced this word market. That's kind of where we might begin the next stage of the conversation, because, you know, there is this kind of latter day presentation of the market as some kind of efficient and driving intelligence, right, which has its forces and it will serve the needs of those participating in the market, and that in some senses that involvement by states in the market, quote unquote, is to somehow compromise that, whereas of course markets are entirely constructed things, which we have constructed and modified always, and as soon as we stop doing that, there is no market, right? They are highly artificial things which we engineer. And that engineering actually can be quite robust without the market, again, to use that phrase, suffering. And one example I use is that, say, you know, say for example, in architecture, there's an awful lot of conversation, a necessary conversation about the built environment and about materials that we use and how we construct. And what's very interesting about that is if you watch in regulated marketplaces like the EU, the slow but faster than you could expect availability of carbon neutral materials to come on stream from the market. And so for a discipline like architecture, doesn't need to invent its own materials. A directed, regulated market, so provoked, can actually start to do that. But then equally problematic behaviours can emerge, where if there is not that involvement in the market will continue to serve needs other than that. And what you're talking about is, well, the entire structure of what the brief of a section of a city will be, what the budget of that would be. And what I'm finding very interesting about those places is just how banal their expression is, which can't be unlinked in the sense that, to go back to that word of place, and I'm going on to Long Island, is that these places are almost linked globally by a language of architecture which is sort of undifferentiated. And again, I'm finding that quite curious. There's an often a language in terms of what these buildings look like, which I don't know if it's Doha or New York anymore or London. And actually, the architects are the same. And the apartments.
Well, I think that's a really big thing. I mean, when the architects are the same, when the people working for the companies are actually the same people, you know, I mean, I've been looking at various schemes where you get, you know, the same person has moved from Elephant Park to the scheme in Malaysia, I can't remember the name, to Barangaroo in Sydney, to Earls Court Development. You know, it's the same person. So when you have the same people, the same companies, it's not any surprise that the schemes are all going to look the same, really.
And what's kind of amazing is the apartments are the same plan.
Well, the apartments also are really underwhelming.
Yes.
You know, you'd expect that, you know, they cost so much money. You go around an apartment which costs more than £1 million for a two-bed apartment, you know, you'd expect that it's pretty nice. And actually, it's really pokey. And the space standards are, you know, really low, really small space standards, low ceilings, strange layouts, which, you know, don't seem to have been done from an architectural point of view, but much more for a cost-saving point of view. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of coverage on how lots of aspects of, well, also the service charges are very high. And then, you know, for the people who do move into these blocks, all sorts of things fail to work and all sorts of problems. So yeah, they look the same. They don't look that great and they don't work that well.
For people.
For people.
What they do work well for, or theoretically work well for, is investment funds driving long-term...
Well, I mean, at the moment.
Yeah.
And we don't even know where that's going. So, I mean, another aspect I talk about is the whole phenomenon of off-plan sales, where developers sell schemes off the plan straight to investors in other parts of the world, in Hong Kong or Southeast Asia or, you know, wherever it might be. And they sell just 5% of the asking price on exchange, then 5% after 12 months, and then another 5% on completion. But, you know, that takes a period of a certain amount of years. And if the market softens, to use the euphemism, investors might, you know, do pull out, you know, which just can lead to huge instability. And actually off-plan sales are actually banned in many European countries, but they drive our development industry.
In the UK.
In the UK.
Yeah, because they get that early cash boost in, it offsets their financial costs.
Yeah.
And then they can go ahead and build. What's very interesting then is there is no qualitative engagement.
But I mean, just to come, sorry, this is not directly relevant to this, but just to come back to your problem, your point about the market, you know, another issue we have is just the monopoly of the big players.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an open and free market. You know, there are huge barriers to entry for smaller and medium-sized players who could actually provide just a much greater diversity diversity.
That's actually broader in the economy too, like in the sense that even state procurement frequently ends up driving towards the same firms, towards the same scales of commercial enterprise. And in fact, actually, when you look at, say, restored or reworked social housing schemes in London, a lot of them look not unlike the corporate languages of the places that you're discussing, which I find interesting. And then what is interesting here about this is that there is also an acute housing need in our society. I worked briefly in Denmark as a professor at Aarhus, and part of that was getting to know the Danish social housing system at the start of the 20th century, when it was sort of invented, which was they had a massive population housing crisis driven by urban migration, disease and other things. And the social housing that emerged came from workers' cooperatives pooling money into what became eventually pension funds and banks, but was manifest initially as good housing. And they had simple models like 25 years to recoup the capital cost and 100 years design life, that kind of thing. Not actually articulated as such, but when you look at the mathematics, that's what they were. And what was quite interesting was that they became very sophisticated. They realized that if people didn't like the places that they were living, they would leave, and that kind of turnover, that lag, produced problems in their model, and they actually produced some really beautiful, delightful long-term housing because that was in their interest to so do. Whereas the housing that you're describing depends on an absolute crisis of housing so that people will pay these rents potentially well above what they would need to pay if this was an actually fair marketplace, if it wasn't being sustained artificially, for things that are actually of extreme inferior quality. And so it's this thing where people are being, on paper they might be relatively well paid, they're paying a high rent for a very average apartment in a place which is generating wealth, not even for social cohesion like a housing cooperative, but for large globalized instruments to make wealthy groups of people even wealthier, if that's correct. So it's sort of feudalism we're talking about, is it? Is it? I mean, at least feudalism produced interesting towns, right? I'm joking.
Yeah, I mean, we've turned our back on public housing. You know, that's been a key plank of the jigsaw of housing policy over the last 30 years. You know, we've just moved completely away from producing any proper, you know, decent social housing. So it's all gone into this sort of so-called affordable housing cross-subsidy model, you know, these very mediocre schemes that we've just been discussing of expensive apartments, which will subsidise a small proportion of affordable housing. And now the definition of affordable housing has been changed to meet up to 80% of market value. So it's not remotely affordable at all. So that's the model that we're looking at. So, I mean, it's just all driven by the bottom line.
And with this other interesting happening at the same time, which is that if you have countries with, you know, a very widespread support for social support, right? So like the UK, for all its ills, does, Ireland does, etc., that you get, once rents get deregulated sometime in the mid-20th century, I'm guessing, rents start rising and social housing production starts to drop off. And so now we have a situation in many countries where rent support for people in social need far exceeds the cost that the state is spending on actual new social
housing.
This
is really out of control in this country. And actually the figures, I think, could be much worse than we're even aware of.
Okay.
So we are spending... Well, no, I don't even want to get into these figures, actually, because I don't know them well enough, and they're different from what they were last time. But I know that we are spending billions and billions on housing benefit in the UK, even though it has been capped for the last few years. So actually, there's a significant gap between the amount that residents get or tenants get in the amount and the amount they need to pay in private rents. In London, that gap is about, well, at least 250 £100 a month. So, you know, evictions are really frequent. But despite that gap, the housing benefit bill straight into the pocket of private landlords. I mean, as I say, I'm reluctant to use figures because I know they're going to be wrong.
Yeah.
But I would say in excess of £11 billion a year. And I think it's very unclear, actually, the extent to which that might be impacting on local authority budgets as well.
Yeah.
And I've tried to look into that. And amazingly, I haven't been given any answers.
So it's not even something we're looking at in the sense that the state isn't really collecting the data, so it's not available.
It's available in different places, and it's very confusing because this department has this and that department has that, and it comes out of this pot and that pot. And, you know, I've talked to the Local Government Association, I've talked to the IFS, I've talked to Shelter, and nobody could tell me the answer to this question. And I am going to look into this when I come. I'm also going to look at the financialisation and of low-income housing in English-speaking economies for my new book. So I'm going to properly dig into it, but I have been quite shocked that nobody knows the answer. You know, there's been quite a lot of coverage about the amount that local authorities are spending on housing homeless people in temporary accommodation. But I suspect there is a tranche of money that is also going into rising benefit bills, which is tipping authorities over the edge. But I'm unclear about it, so I'm a little bit reluctant to, you know, say
no,
too much.
No, I can hear that. I can imagine, and that's the researcher and the academic community. You want to be precise. But I think listeners will be more than aware of the kind of picture you're talking about,
yeah.
At least in English-speaking economies, which do seem to have a certain congruence in
well,
terms of...
Well, yeah, I mean,
thinking.
What I felt. That's why, I mean, that's what I've chosen for the new book. I'm going to look at English-speaking economies, so the UK, Ireland, North America, Australia, New Zealand, because, you know, this is a global issue. It needs a global lens, but at the end of the day, you can't write a book about the whole world. But like you say, there is enough parallel, I think, between the particularly extreme form of capitalism that, you know, we're the outliers.
This is true.
And also, you know, we're all the recipients of what's called, you know, some academics would call fast policy transfer from the US to the UK or, you know, wherever else, where there's an uncanny similarity between so many urban policies and actually so many policies regarding housing benefits as well, which are all really similar as well, despite the fact that they don't seem to work well in any country.
The state switches from spending on capital investment in long-term durable assets for the greater good to current expenditure on support that goes to landlords or to relatively wealthy individuals or funds, which further exacerbates the problem, right? And so there's this question, which is, I mean, maybe at some point in your book, a number becomes clear that the UK is spending a week on this and we could put it on a bus and maybe have a referendum about whether this is something that the UK population supports. Because I do think with these very big issues, it's precisely, they're like trying to pick up mercury with a fork, and that diaphanous, ephemeral nature is how they persist. Because as soon as you can name it, capture it, it becomes clear that reform is not only possible but necessary in a way.
Yeah, but it would require a turning around of the supertanker. You know, the supertanker moved into a direction a long time ago of saying we don't build subsidised housing anymore. We subsidise people to live in the private sector. And once that started spiralling out of control with soaring rents in the private sector, you know, there's just sort of paralysis. No, nobody's able to do anything about it.
And now we get into the kind of question about democracy and the structures that shape our countries. And what would... I mean, you feel free to say you don't want to answer it. But if you had policy changes, Anna, like with the research that you've done, what kind of things would you suggest to a country like Ireland or England, or that they would start to do?
I don't think it's that difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think we need a really substantial social housing programme. You know, we need properly affordable housing, and that word affordable housing should just be, you know, banned. It's just become so Orwellian. So proper social housing. We need a significant social housing programme. And, you know, Labour haven't put a figure on that, which is really disappointing. All they've said is, oh, we're going to ungum the planning system so we can build more homes. And we all know that's not going to happen, because actually it's not in the interests of developers to provide the number of homes that the government would like them to build. They're going to provide the number of homes that it makes sense for their balance sheets. You know, that's their job.
Mm.
So there's a real confusion. I mean, housing is a paradox. It's both a social good and it's a financial asset. And we're looking at it as a financial asset only and expecting it to provide its social value. And of course, it's not.
And all these things, in a way, boil down to what a country's take on human happiness might be, or societal well-being might be. Because at some point, it was self-evident to everybody, particularly post-war, that social housing was just necessary. And at some other point, and people associated with Thatcher, but it was in the water, it probably would have happened even if she didn't exist in some form, it became believable that individual wealth was linked with individual agency and happiness. And that transaction is really the switch that we're talking about. But it does feel, in many respects, that societal consciousness has switched back. If you look at the kind of, while the younger generation that we're teaching and that you'll be speaking to now shortly are the most individualized in human history by virtue of social media and other things, they're also the one most seeking social cohesion in a long time, looking for social collective action in a long time. Now, it's not up to them to have the answers, it's up to other generations to enact change. But I do think that that does seem to have switched back. It doesn't seem, like in the 80s, it felt like a river that was flowing a particular direction, if I'm right.
Yeah.
But it's quite clear now that that's a dead end in terms of human flourishing of any kind, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, and until the financial crash, arguably, there were enough benefits for perhaps even the majority of the population for the system to hold together. And those benefits are no longer there. No. You know, when you have Michael Gove saying the housing crisis is a threat to democracy, you know that the issue is being taken seriously, but unfortunately, they're not able to offer any solutions.
And that's because of dogmatism and a certain kind of intractable belief in the market, which goes back to this thing. And the interesting thing being is if you look at the high value properties, are the better built properties, are the desirable properties now in certain parts of London, they're frequently the social housing that became private because they were better built. They have certain design standards which weren't available in the market. And there is this thing which is that the state as an innovator, or the state as the bearer of risk, was a kind of collective belief that went away for a while.
And I think it's really difficult because, you know, we can talk about how, oh, well, if we could get back to that. But it's very difficult to see how we could get back to that, because councils today are not what councils were when they were pioneering those sorts of social housing projects, and where, you know, there was a borough architect. There's no borough architect anymore. Planners really don't have much of a role at all. It's probably why planners didn't like ground control very much in the end, because I think they saw it as a broadside against them. And it's local authorities which actually are in the vanguard of seeking these partnerships with developers to build these privatised neighbourhoods. And I think they do that because they think they've got no alternative.
And to some extent, in the current context, they may well be right. in the main. And I think that the way that change happens, doesn't it? It doesn't, with these big organisms, like, you know, London 100 years ago is very different now. It would be impossible for somebody in London 100 years ago to envisage the London that we see now. The London that you imagine with social housing as a common good could well be present in 50 years' time again in a way that seems inevitable to those inhabitants, but to us seems incredibly distant. I'm stupidly optimistic, Anna, but it is how I kind of think, in the sense that I do see, say if we go back to the question of resilience or the idea of how we might navigate in response to the climate crisis. No, we're not moving anywhere near as fast as anyone would want, but we're moving faster than we thought we would be, like 5, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and no call for complacency. But it is to say that collective action is possible and change is possible. But then the question is then, and I think the reason why people are attracted to your books from the architectural conversation is because it makes sense of a lot of things that we see in the industry. You know, we see it in our side of the table.
I suppose, sorry to sort of chop and change and interrupt you.
I like it.
But, I mean, in Ground Control and in Big Capital, I was sort of reaching at this sort of bigger idea, which is that the lack of cohesion and the loss of cohesion wrought by the privatized, commodified city is leading to a much more populist and right-wing politics. And I didn't really, like, surface that or dig into it too much.
Okay, so now I see where you're going. So there's this commodified, desaturated urbanism where political discourse is sort of in the main discouraged, and even in public owned spaces. And then we have this online sphere of radicalized, populized, frequently hate oriented conversation. And you're saying,
we also have a cost of living crisis, you know, ongoing austerity, really hard times for so many people who feel disenfranchised or are attracted to strong, clear messages.
Yeah, so you don't see in that a policy-driven response could garner democratic support?
Well, I think there have been moments of feeling that. And, you know, I think the sort of left resurgence in the UK a few years ago and still in the US, you know, the sort of Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party speaks to that. And I think that is the case, but it's very metropolitan, isn't it? It's that sort of metropolitan, you know, it's got that sort of metropolitan veneer. It's in London, it's in other cities, you know.
It's not for everybody.
It's not for everybody. It got smashed to bits after 2019. You know, there was a really, I think, quite exciting and encouraging progressive platform. And the failure of the Labour Party has just seen that be annihilated, and you can't see really any of that left now.
Yeah. How is that going to be? Those policies have been dismantled. They're not on the ballot paper.
Well, they don't seem to be at the moment. I mean, you never know. You know, the Labour Party is a big, broad church, and it's impossible to know what will actually transpire. But in as much as Ground Control was a broadside against New Labour, I can't feel that optimistic because it does seem that some of those key figures are in very pivotal positions in the current Labour Party.
I hear you. I mean, I can't speak enough about UK politics of an Irish person, I mean, but there are rhymes in what you're saying.
One thing I would say is that it's not just about policy at the top. And there have been really, really significant changes since the New Labour period, which was a boom time period. And it was one thing enacting that sort of programme in a boom period. This is a really different sort of period. Mm. And especially around issues to do with housing, people do want something really, really different. But I don't know, you know, if policy will be able to deliver anything like that.
It's interesting. I was And we're moving now to wrapping up the chat, but although we could go on. But the thing is that in all of this, as somebody who teaches students, and both of us are, I remember I was in Zurich before Christmas to do some reviews, and I was talking to some students afterwards, and there was one student, and she was saying, oh, you know, I've done this unit and this unit and this unit, and they were all very, you know, very right on, very, like, you know, very directional about ethics, shall we say, basically telling the students what their ethics should be. It was pretty good progressive ethics, I don't know, nothing. But that bitch said, but now, any job that I do, I have sold out. And so she said, oh, but I have to, I'm not rich, I have to do work. And I said, no. Like, you do have to do work. You don't confuse ethical puritanism with an inability to do work. And I just wanted to talk about this, because as architects, we swim in contested waters. Only the truly privileged architects who are independently wealthy can pick and choose briefs, right? The rest of us who want to make a living from this work where we can get work. Now I want to talk to you about the possibilities for little acts of resistance, or how those things work, both within and without architecture. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get asked this sort of question quite a lot.
Yes.
At the end of an event to an architecture audience, this will come up. Who can we work for?
Yeah.
And it's a really tricky question, and I agree with you. I mean, you have to work. At the same time, there may be some projects which may not be for you, you know, if those sorts of issues are really important to you. You know, there's a range of work out there. And yeah, I wouldn't take a really puritanical approach. I think the main thing is to know what's going on.
I think that's right.
And then you're in a better place to make your choices, and you're probably in a better place to do your job. I mean, in terms of what you can do sort of on the margins and, you know, in the sort of interstitial spaces, I mean, that's always the question. Is it structural, systemic change, or is it small, incremental steps? And, you know, you need both.
Yeah.
And you can be constantly on the lookout for the smaller stuff. I mean, I'm involved in the smaller stuff too. I don't think it's going to change anything tomorrow, but there's a couple of projects that I'm involved with that I feel really excited about. And I'm not the pessimist that I hope I'm not sounding like a pessimist.
No.
Because I like to actually think, well, you know, despite the difficulties that we're facing, we're having a lot of really open conversations, which, let's say 15 years ago, we weren't having those open conversations.
No, I think you're right, and I really like what you said there, and it's true, because I think the most of the listeners to this podcast are students, and what I think is that you, first of all, being an architect doesn't describe your full citizenship. You are also a political member of society. You also have families. You also have groups that you can be attached to. And you, look, activism, which is a thing which has become sort of a colonized area by certain people at the moment, it can be very good, but it can also be quite pernicious. It isn't for everybody. But actually, you can be activist in other ways. You can be activist by being a good designer, making the house for the family on the small plot, if you can. That's not as capital P political. But it can be a way that you grow in the discipline. And actually, there's a funny thing that happens with life, which people don't talk enough about, which is that you grow up and you get older and your friends are older. And suddenly they're in positions of power and suddenly opportunities are different. And I think part of it is not confusing ethical purity that might be presented in the rarefied world of academia as being what your role in society is. It'll always be contested. But there's a route to a better, there's a route to a difference that's positive, that involves some steps that might not always be positive, but the broad trajectory, which you are in control of, can be.
Yeah, and also I'd say that it's impossible not to be complicit
in something,
yeah. In something if you want to make your way through life, you know. And I mean, there are all sorts of things that, you know, I do in my life that probably do not you know, match up to any standards of ethical purity. But, you know, I try and do my best where I can do my best, and where I feel that I have to make compromises, sometimes I have to make compromises.
What you have to make sure is that your overall impetus is positive, and that you are actually not holding yourself to some impossible account. I mean, this is fine, because rhetorically you can be very pure in an academic context, but actually being out in the world, not that the university is not part of the world, but you know the distinction I'm making, I think it's a route also to positive change, that in a way you can't speak with the same puritanism, but I think you can speak on a deeper level about the things that you've witnessed. And yeah. I think,
but also when you leave education, I mean, I don't want to talk down to an audience of, you know, student listeners, but you still don't know that much about what the world is like. You know, I didn't know what journalism was going to be like when I left university. I had a really different idea. Actually, it was my experience of journalism which radicalized me to quite a large degree. But, you know, I didn't start out by avoiding certain jobs. I did those jobs, saw what they were like, and learned quite a lot, which wasn't particularly enjoyable, but has stood me in quite good stead. I mean, I think, you know, today's architecture graduates, they're older, it's a postgraduate degree, you have a much better knowledge, you've had a year in industry already. But I think you can't be sort of, you know, too prescriptive about what's going to happen. If I'd been prescriptive, you know, I started somewhere really different from where I am now.
No, that's really lovely, because normally we end these interviews with the question of, if you had to give advice to a student studying today, what would it be? But I think you've done that, which is, and you've actually evidenced it with your own career, which is that some grand strategy for your career is impossible. It's not possible. But if you're curious about your own affinities, your own curiosities, and you're rigorous about your pursuit of those with missteps, you can make a powerful contribution.
I think that's right. And, you know, I do think also, you know, having talked about ethical purity, if you're somewhere and something happens, you know, or you're asked to do something and it feels really wrong, well, you know, then it probably is.
Yeah.
And that's something to listen to. But, you know, equally, just be really, as you say, curious and open-minded about, you know, all manner of possibilities.
Anna Minton, thank you so much for your time. We're going to put up the links to your book in the description, so do buy them and keep an eye out for the new one. Do you know when it's going to be released? Or that's a dreadful question to ask.
Well, yeah, especially as it's not really been written. 2026.
2026, we'll be front of the queue, Anna. Thank you.
And it will be about sterilisation of the city.
And I think we're going to be hearing about that in the talk, so yeah, looking forward to that. Thank you so much. Brilliant.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Register. Really enjoyed that. Thanks again to Anna. Join us in a few weeks' time when the next episode will feature the Belgian architect Kirsten Geers. I'll see you then. Thanks a million. Bye.